This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Some of you were with us last night at Princeton, and some of you were with us this afternoon, and some of you are completely new to this project, and here we are sitting in the midst of it, which is very different than being in an auditorium very distant from it. So I'm going to try to open up, and we're going to each contribute to something you might be seeing right around you or on the screen. A little bit of a history of the project that might open up the journey. I was struck by 6 years. I'm not sure that's accurate. It might even be more.
Yeah.
It's been a long process and an evolving process, and you're going to see, we're going to try and give you a feeling for how the form has evolved to where it is now. So we're going to show you first, this was the first iteration. The project kind of began with Wendy and I around a kitchen table discussing how the notion of collaboration came to both of us in our practice, more or less at the same time, but in different approaches, with slightly different approaches. And we were thinking about really what the origin of
some of the work that we'd seen affected us,
that kind of inspired us, and you know, resonated with us in that early period. So we're both beginning best practitioners on the cusp of 1970-71, early years, for even what one would have seen published or on the walls if you'd lived in New York, in fact. So it's a long time ago for many of you, I can see by the audience. Hopefully some of you were born. But anyway, this conversation was really trying to think about just in a very abstract way, and we began it and then began to invite others to participate. And so without giving you every stage, I think the reason we jumped to this is the first time we tried to visualize and create a vocabulary for these ideas that were evolving. And our vocabulary included the notion of a project, which as you see all around you, which became compressed into a square, and the square then evolved into a grid, which made it very modular, movable, and relatable, hopefully, through thematically. So each grid had an idea within which there were maybe counterpoints. So I'm not sure where you're sitting exactly what you're seeing, but it could be co-archiving, which is this square, this grid, set of squares in a grid. Each of the grids you're seeing around you have this collective cluster orienting text. Do you want to speak immediately
to
the text?
Yes, well, actually, so it's such a pleasure for me anyway to see this on the wall, because all the little, I mean, you should look at the configuration of what all these little pictures do. How they look as little pictures, and they draw the eye. But while your eye is being drawn to the pictures, I want to remind you about the text. Because each one of these, what we call clusters, have a cluster title, and then there's a cluster text. And these are also conceptually very important in understanding what the project is about. There's a series of 8 clusters here, and they have titles like The Photographed Person Was Always There, or Co-Archiving, or Potentializing Violence, which is in the corner back there. And then there's this kind of somewhat poetic text that's trying to unpack the ideas that might be associated with those names of, again, a set of thoughts that these photographs are in dialogue with, so that as we're pulled to look at the pictures, don't forget the words. My experience with photographers has often been that the words are secondary, but in this project,
well,
they're not.
Well, I don't
not,
know yeah. whether they're secondary
okay.
or not. I think they're probably pretty
collaborative.
Counterpoint. Yeah, right, okay.
And,
yeah.
And also what we try to do in making these squares is to have the pictures and the text speak for themselves rather than to analyze what's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're grouped, and that gives you a framework of looking at them. But the voices are, we try to get voices of, for everyone, of either the photographer or the photographed person, so that there's more than one voice, and really to create stories that, you know, tell succinctly, you know, what is going on.
So even as you entered the gallery, you saw a table of multiple books, and many of those books speak to what we would call an exploded square. Another one square is really is a compression from a whole project that might have greater depth, and we're abstracting it, and you know, that's sort of a daring act. In terms of the process, someone asked us in the last day or so how we got to that. We did do all of this as open source research. Either we had seen work, we had heard about work, we were researching the work, and essentially then invited those who had produced the work to respond to our, you could say, abstraction or reduction in some ways, to feel comfortable enough with the choices we've made about the images or the text, and people in dialogue then responded and sometimes made alterations. I think it's also important, just because we're in this space, you can see these blank squares in most of the grids, and they are suggesting that there are always more stories, more projects, more thinking and research to do. So that was also a very important part of our basic language as we developed this.
And then in the other room, there's also on one of the walls a manifesto. Mm-hmm. So we actually tried to address the question after several years of why are we doing this, and what is the politics of the positioning vis-a-vis thinking about what we learn about the history of photography. Why are we doing this? And it has very much to do with this idea of a potential history. This is an attempt to re-look at the history of photography through as a potential history, through the lens of collaboration. So not just what we tend to learn is the development of different styles or projects or photographic interventions that are the achievement of single people, single great people. We want to say, well, actually, photography is always inherently collaborative. And when you look at the single people and give them the name, the historical importance, you've excised much of the event of photography. And we are trying to figure out how to write a history, how to make a history, how to share, how to collaborate on a history that doesn't make that excision. Our reasons why are in the manifesto, and our kind of thinking about it are not the texts that are in the squares, but the texts that are to the side. And then there's the result of that thinking. So this is a proposition. It's an experiment. It's still ongoing, and these are propositions that you can take up.
It's both a proposition and a manifesto, actually. Yeah. It's right in between. So what we have up is the photograph person was always there. Laura, I know.
Yeah.
This
well,
is one of
was
Laura's
my
favorite
entry point. When I fell in love with the project is when I heard that sentence. It is a sentence. The photograph person was always there. Somehow it sounded to me like almost sort of an interior, it sounded like a poetry, but almost an interior revelation that found words, that is a reminder of something you always knew but didn't have public words for. The photograph person, so it's a whisper to me that says the photograph person was always there. What does that mean? And we had a very interesting discussion earlier today about what that might mean, because my understanding was initially it meant that there's a perdurance, there's the photograph, the person photographed, is there before, is there during, is there after, and that's important in thinking about the event of photography. But also then Eduardo was saying that to him it also meant the photographed person is always there, meaning not here, right? The photographed person is always, there's always that kind of distance. So that's the way poetry works. And these cluster titles are fragments of, to me, they're fragments of poetry that allow me to think differently. I've been trying to think with these fragments of ideas.
So this grid is actually in the other room, and you can't see it in here, but do you want to speak to some of other squares that are in it? What we focused on, the Stieglitz and O'Keeffe, as just one. If you go back one, so these are all interrelating within the cluster, and the basic concept of the photographed person was always there. So Laura, do you want to?
Yeah. Well, take a look at the one on the third one from the left, Ken Gonzalez Day's project about photographs of lynching in the Southwest with this Hispanic community. So this is not the story of lynching that most of us know more about, but indeed there's more and more to learn about histories of lynching. And what he's done is to erase the lynched person and keep the people who are watching, the attendees. They are also photographed persons, and they were always there. But we haven't always paid so much attention to them. Many of these are still open crimes, ongoing situations. These people are still alive. Historians now are going back to communities and trying to uncover the trail of these crimes. The photographed person was always there, and in a sense, because they're photographed, they will always be there. It's a very powerful statement about who is the photographed person and where are they. So that's one example. What else is here? The one we have circled.
Curtis and Pula. Stieglitz.
Yeah.
But before you go to Stieglitz, maybe.
So do people know Edward Curtis's the North American Indian Project? Have you ever? Yeah. So you know that J.P. Morgan, with a lot of money, financed decades of Curtis's devoted work going all over to make, it's what we call salvage ethnography, to make a record of what he construed as a vanishing race. And one of the most famous photographs is entitled The Vanishing Race. That was just a truism, and the idea was, let's get a very honorable record of these people before they disappear. And that's what that engagement is about. And they're very beautiful photogravures, and it was incredibly high production. They were expensive. People had them. Universities have them. Libraries have them. But they froze the popular conception of Native American life in a number of ways. One, they're really reenactments for Curtis, right, directed reenactments. And second of all, they took all the air in the room. It was J.P. Morgan and Curtis, and they became the go-to representation of Native peoples. And even still, Native photographers, Native peoples, have to work against the images of them that Curtis created. There are indeed many interesting projects trying to do that. So the photographed person was always there, quite literally, not disappeared. Collaborative with the process, with Curtis, why and how were those collaborations made? It raises all kinds of questions about the idea of collaboration, which we don't want you to understand only in an anodyne way, that collaboration is just always hunky-dory, everybody's on an even terrain, and we go happily onward from there. This is a very complex collaboration over 30 years that raises many questions for us. Horace Pula is a community photographer, and he photographed his own native community And he never sold any prints, and there is no J.P. Morgan behind this. I think after he died, his children found the negatives. Most of them were not printed, and they printed them, and the Smithsonian had a show, and there's a book. So this is an entirely community-based photographic practice that is also collaborative over 30, 40 years with the community. And it shows, of course, hugely different ongoing, the people are there, the people are always there, than the Curtis images do. Do you want to talk about
that? Well, I just would say another thing about this, how fluid this process is, that Eric Etheridge, who's somewhere back there, who we met essentially last night for the first time, but whose work we discovered through Lens Blog on the New York Times, but a very important project from our view and others, of course, that he had photographed. He had researched the mugshots that were made in 1961 of the Freedom Riders, and in so doing then revisited. There's a whole long story that Eric might tell us as well, how he found those people, re-photographed them, and bringing them into our contemporary consideration about them. I don't know how long the project was, Eric.
Well, it's still ongoing. I did the first volume after in about 4 years. And I just published an updated edition last month. So in paperback, a little cheaper, and has even more Freedom Riders.
And how many actually are in the first collection? How many people did you find in the first collection?
In the first book, there's like 82 or 3.
So how many of us even knew there were 80, right? That number,
maybe
that
people
scale.
Don't even know totally
the
what
book is
the situation
on the table.
Is.
No, I think we bought your book and brought this book here. So some of you might want to talk to Eric and look at the book. And again, we're going to try and skip across and invite you to re-examine the walls. And we're just trying to give you a hint of how to think about the project. Do you want to go to the next, I think? So Stieglitz and George O'Keefe, a relationship of multiple years, he being much older and famous compared to her as an artist at the time. I don't know if you got to read this. I guess I'll read it because back there you can't. Stieglitz photographed me first at his gallery 291 in the spring of 1917. My hands had always been admired since I was a little girl, but I never thought much about it. He wanted head and hands and arms on a pillow in many different positions. I was asked to move my hands in many different ways, also my head, and I had to turn this way and that. Stieglitz had a very sharp eye for what he wanted to say with the camera. When I look over the photographs Stieglitz took of me, some of them more than 60 years ago, I wonder who that person is. It is as if in my one life, I have lived many lives. So it's a voice, and one of the things that we explore progressively is how that voice, was that voice of consent? Was it a full acknowledgement of how she was then portrayed publicly? In fact, you know, and you'll see in the grid, there are lots of nude photographs that everyone has come to know of O'Keefe, and to what extent was she collaborating intentionally with that exposure? So that's just an example of one square in this grid.
So this, we sort of generally start with in this order. So this is sort of the response, you know, to bringing out the photographed persons, which a lot of these projects we realize sort of began in the 70s. And also it was a time when people were investigating snapshots for the first time. So, for example, I guess my square there, and then I'll let you talk about Jim, is Kentucky, Appalachia in the 70s. And I, as Susan has said, as a young person, just graduated from college, went there to work with a multimedia cooperative, which was also something that was happening at that time called Apple Shop. And so I began a project with them looking at photography. And I got cameras and film from Polaroid, which was a very incredible also source of a lot of work during this time, and had them photograph. The kids that I worked with were in a small or one room school, so I asked them to photograph themselves, their families, their community, their dreams or fantasies, and built a dark room, etc. And the book came out of that, which was I guess sort of, you know, one of the first. Not the first, but one of the first books looking at how regular people made photographs, and that it was possible, you know, for them to make photographs that reached all kinds of people and institutions, and you know, they were shown in museums and etc. And then you have Jim Goldberg, who is using text. To respond to the pictures he's taken of rich people and poor people, which sort of then explodes the photograph in that you get the you get their response to how they're pictured, which in many cases is so different than you might have thought, but. So I think it was a time really when, or we were looking for ways to make a document that was much deeper than what we'd seen with just images.
I mean, you can't read this, but just as an example, to Jim, my life is personal, but I will tell you one thing, I'm too fat, Samuel. You know, it just opens up the voice of the photographed person to participate in the representation that the image is only partially rendering. Can you go back to the grid for a sec? Because I think they're... So one of the things that happens in these grids, and you might want to go revisit later, is that you start to see resonances. If you look, they're not completely chronological. They're interactive. So for one of the things I find fascinating is you hear Wendy talking about early 70s in Kentucky. Another photographer, Omar Iman, Syrian refugee working amongst refugees just a couple of years ago, inviting the refugees to enact their dreams and nightmares, actually. Wendy was doing dreams and some nightmares. I think mostly dreams.
Nightmares.
Oh, really?
Well, so they're much easier to make.
But what's very interesting is Omar had no idea about, he'd never met Wendy, he'd never seen her work, etc. But he had very limited opportunities and wanted to make a set of photographs that spoke to the refugees and you know, came from his relationship with them. So that's, you know, quite a number of years apart, very similar inspiration. You know, another, something else that's about writing, as we say, writing Jim in 1985, I think it is, having people write on the photographs, and a project Bika de Porter did, a Belgian photographer going back to Egypt, with the photograph she'd made to find out from them how they saw what she had imaged. And in her case, and you can see the book out there, the images are completely written over in Arabic. So she had no idea what they were writing, but they just responded to the object that they saw. They weren't necessarily in the image, they just responded to what they thought the image was portraying. And then a different kind of, as this is the photograph. The photographer reshapes the traditional authorial position through the photographed person's collaboration. So another way we're opening up this question is a writer-photographer team. This is Eugene Richards and Dory. Dory writing a diary and a journal of the process of encountering and confronting breast cancer, and Eugene portraying his wife, Dory, in that process. So they work collaboratively, but then there is a tension between the writer and the photographer together telling the story. One without the other would not have been as complete. So should we keep? I'm just going to become the human pointer. So you guys,
no.
So iconicization is preceded by collaboration. Do you want to take on Migrant Mother?
Yep.
Let's, Aaron, let's show a detail. It's probably harder for you. This is also in the other room, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in the idea behind this this grouping is that, you know, first of all, Florence Thompson, who's the woman pictured here, really collaborated with Dorothea Lange to make this photograph. And then the photograph became a symbol of a whole era and terrible situation. And then she loses her identity in this process. And I think in, I'm not sure what Dorothea Lange means now, but the negative now belongs to the Library of Congress, which supervises it and prints it. Until now, it is her picture, not mine. I mean, I would beg to differ on that, because it becomes
well,
she loses herself. And
let's see the second slide.
Yeah, but also
this is about time, though. This is about when Dorothea Lange is writing that, she's saying, this is not my photograph.
Well, I don't know when she's saying that.
But it's more, I think what you want to speak to is the Florence Thompson response, who's the migrant mother herself.
No, yeah, that's another thing.
Yeah,
sort of two layers. And she is tired of, you know, being a symbol. But also another thing that I didn't know until Laura told me last night, is there's a famous story about a thumb.
Go back one.
It's been erased,
Aaron,
for that one.
It's been erased.
There's
for both of them?
There's a thumb on the...
No, it's not on the left-hand side, though. We tried.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, it's there.
Yeah, there. See the thumb?
Can you see it? There's a thumb that comes around. And it's people have always talked about, oh, is the thumb in there? And I never understood, you know, other than cropping, what was going on.
What's wrong with the thumb?
Yeah.
So this is an FSA photograph. Dorothea Lange is working for the Roosevelt government, and they are trying to give propaganda support for the Roosevelt programs of giving aid to migrant workers. So one of the reactions when the pictures were displayed, somebody wrote on, you know, you write your response to an exhibit in a book, somebody wrote, teach the poor to have fewer children and you won't need to give them so much money. So the FSA photographers are negotiating between showing a really difficult situation and showing a acceptable subject of poverty. And the thumb represents another child who's there. And so that's too many children. So
it's essentially erased.
It's erased there. It's there.
Very small detail.
So that's a
sharp eye.
You know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, there are stories and photographic lore, that's
yeah,
one of them.
Potentializing violence is another. It is on the back wall to the right, so some of you who are back there can take a look too. I mean, I think Laura, you spoke so well about this that it's both the, you might want to say that and then I can explain about Mark Garinger, or I'll say something about Mark Garinger and then you can fill in with the S21. I mean, Mark Garinger is a French photographer who goes to the Algerian War as a French soldier who is also a photographer, and he's asked to, or told to, as it were, document the women who have to be de-veiled in order for him to record them. It's quite a...
It's a long French history of that.
A long French history. And then he goes back. Do you want to just show the next slide, which makes it a little easier to see? So these are the photographs, and he writes, this was war, and they were forced to be photographed, so there was no communication. This had to happen. I had to take the picture, and they had no choice in being photographed. They were firing at me with their eyes. So actually, it resonates with even Eric collecting the mugshots that the Southern police, wherever they were taken, a very similar idea, and that goes back to your notion of, you know, it's not always a positive collaboration. Mm-hmm. Do you want to, let's go back to the grid, and you want to talk about S21?
Well, this is a hard one for us. When I first heard I didn't make the title Potentializing Violence, and it frightened me when I first heard it. Mm-hmm. because I thought, well, who wants to make violence? I mean, that is what photographs do, create the potential for violence. And we could argue that photographs are, you know, our web, the web is doing that for us now.
Yeah, so it's not just the using the photograph as evidence of violence, yeah. like with the lynching photographs we just talked about, right? Mm. I mean, maybe yeah. talk about Nona in response to, I mean, I don't know how you want to take
it. Oh, well, I was just going to say, but then I began, when we were working with this grid, and we've been working for a long time, I began to, my understanding of that shifted, and I started to understand that it's a question about what to do about violence. What? How can we take the violent histories of the our common world and imagine forward, take that, not discard it, not disregard it, but take it and do something with it so that there's this potential to it. So, but this is the S21 photographs are difficult. You know what these are. These are the photographs of Cambodians who were being executed by the Khmer Rouge, and they're in a school, actually. And they're photographed. There's a photographer. He makes their portrait, and then they go into the schoolyard and get killed. So these are photographs of these people. And the event came to the general American audience in a sort of coffee table book. You may have seen this book, beautiful production value, really sort of fancy book. Unlike the lynching photographs without Sanctuary, where there also was a white box show and a fancy production, that was the people protested, and so it was taken down, and the New York Historical Society did an important and careful show about even the history of the Dyer anti-lynching bill and really contextualizing it. This has not been recontextualized. And a scholar that we work with in Canada, Ti Phu, who's a Vietnamese immigrant Canadian and who works in the history of photography. Actually, she's writing a book about the photographs of the Vietnam War, really was uneasy about this, even showing it, because there are, if you go there now, there's a museum in commemoration of all the people, but there are also reenactors, and there are also people who were involved in the original, perpetrating the original violence, helping, selling souvenirs, and being part of the tourist industry that is there. So potentializing violence can get screwed up, I guess. It's not, it's troubling.
But maybe a counterpoint, the top square here in this row is kind of an extraordinary project by a group of photographers speaking to prisoners in various jails. It's called the TAMS Project, in which they've invited the prisoners to direct them as people, free people, floating out in the world to perform the service of a photographer for their own benefit in the sense of what would they like to see that they don't have freedom to confront themselves. And these pictures are both made by a group of photographers, not closely associated in a collective, who respond to the request that the prisoner has and then send the picture to the within the prison. So it's another angle on what else. In a way, the catcalls is another surprising project that came out of a workshop. One thing we didn't say, though we said it earlier, was this kind of a, we haven't done this kind of a audience conversation very often, but we have done a lot of workshops in classes at Brown and at Yale, Laura and Ariella, and that has invited students to contribute new ideas of projects to include, one of which was this one, came out of your class.
Yeah.
Do you want to describe what she did?
I mean,
it's kind of a, it's very relatable, I think.
The so cat calls, it was about walking down the street and recording the cat calls.
As a young woman.
As a young woman. in Philly, actually.
Was
I
it Philly?
It's Philly.
Do you all know this project?
About that project?
Have you seen this project? She asks, she goes right up to the guy that called her and said, can I take your picture? I mean, it's a very bold, immediate response. She hears the cat call, and she then confronts them, and then they participate. They collaborate with her and their conversations that are exchanged. So it's a kind of interesting, active response.
So you already see that this is not a linear or a cumulative history. It's rather a compilation of idiosyncratically found ideas about how to use the situation of photography collaboratively in order to show the photographed person as always there, or potentialize violence, or redraw the relationship between the photographer. So that's the use of these titles. These are ideas and experiments and practices and work involved in these notions of how to do this. It's not the way we normally learn of the history of photography.
Which goes back to, this is a, you know, the core collective is a made up of historians, and theorists, practitioners, and so as viewers, we're all as viewers processing and trying to make sense of what we're seeing around us. So we're encouraging these interactive environments almost for you to make your own free associations, and those blank squares are to contribute future ideas that we've not considered or thought of. And actually, one of the earlier workshops we had, and maybe we should tell Aaron this, multicolored post-it notes so that you could contribute in a kind of streamed way, saying that, you know, an idea that we don't have, a different color representing something that you don't think belongs in the grid as we associate it to be. I mean, we've had more interactive with audiences that have come to get responses.
So why would we want to do this? I mean, I think that that's a question you might ask, and why? And it's a huge project, and it's been years, and there's more and more. There's more to do, but I, in thinking about this question, I've realized there's a history. The history of collaboration has a little bit been buried. I realized this because I was just sort of a week ago. I was in Paris at the first ever conference on Frederick Douglass in France, maybe even possibly in Europe, but certainly in France. And people who do something called the Colored Conventions Project, coloredconventions.org, Gabrielle Forman and others, have found it's from 1830 to 1890, I think, so 50 years. 50 years of yearly meetings of African Americans to make a politics, to forge a strategy, to claim citizenship. 40 years, 50 years. Douglass never missed one of these for 40 years. And their work was profoundly collaborative. And the records of this have just been scattered and mainly erased. The internet has, this is a digital humanities project, crowdsourced, and it has allowed all these minutes and records to be brought together. But the technique of taking a large and unevenly educated audience with differential levels, or group, differential levels of access to social power, and making collaborative statements, doing collaborative work, that was like, oh yes, of course. If that's your group, that's the kind of way you need to work. You're in an emergency, and you need to work. You need to work. And I think I hope it comes across in the manifesto. Certainly, since we wrote the manifesto, it's clearer and clearer that we are in the kind of time when we need one another. We don't have any of us full access to the forces that we need, or the ideas that we need. We need to be thinking together about our situation. And so that history of photography, which became a history of great men mostly, and excised everybody else who was active, is an example of how the history of collaboration we've just kind of left it to the side. This is an effort to use the photographic situation to refine the history of collaboration because it's so deeply collaborative. At least that's our argument.
So should we take a few questions?
Yeah.
Anybody dare to ask or make a comment or critique of what you're seeing or questions about we haven't touched
maybe
on?
You just want to hold the microphone.
There's no wine until there's some questions.
There you go.
It's been great hearing you guys talk about this project last night and tonight. I'm just curious how you see the development of the grids, and you know, I can think of like I don't know, half a dozen projects. Like, why don't you have, you know, this? Why don't you have that? And I'm wondering if you're looking to be exhaustive, indexical in any way, or just you're making, you know, why, you know, just like how, why don't you have Zeely up here somewhere? And you know, I guess it's just in the conversation that you guys have. I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's a great question. At what point, one thing is to point back to where it all began, and then the question is for anybody making any work, when does it end? You just said you're going on to your next volume of how many Freedom Riders were. We thought the number you mentioned was already a stand. So I think this question of closure is very complicated, or a fixed form. We're considering many things. Some of you know we've thought about a box. When you go to the table, you'll see those laminated squares, which are 12 inch by 12 inch. These are about 25 inches. So that's a square that's manageable. And when we teach, when Laura with her class or Ariella teach, they move the squares around and respond. We see it as a great teaching tool to open up questions, not necessarily answer them all. We've been thinking about a book and what form will a book feel too fixed? Is there something digital that we could do? Would we have the resources to do that? At what point do you put closure to a project that obviously should inspire more and more, but maybe we can't encompass it all? It's not supposed to be a full authoritarian, authoritative account of collaboration.
Really, but you just answered. You said, why isn't X there?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we want. That's the question. And you add to it that way. I don't think we can only, you know, put in what we think of. But that it, precisely that it says, oh, but there's this, oh, there's this, oh, there's this. That is the promise of the project.
And it also depends on who we want the audience to be. I mean, we've had one kind of audience, and you know, do we want to, you know, make it a book so that it, you know, it can move around much more easily and much more cheaply. So,
I mean, we should say that every time, and this is the third time we've had it on the walls, so to speak. So first in Aperture, then we went to Toronto to Ryerson, which really museumified a bit more the project. And you can see in the blue tape version, the Ryerson, I think it's not in this PowerPoint, Aaron. I think we put it in the other one.
You should show the film too.
The film of the panoramic? Why don't you just jump to the end, that last slide. It just gives you a feeling of the dynamic that the different settings have created. In other words, you all came
in.
That's Ryerson.
This is Ryerson, the manifesto. This was an active workshop. There's Laura and Wendy. And then this slide is the little movie. This was back to Aperture. We had no idea how people would respond. You all came in and immediately knew what to do at Slot, which was grab a seat, right? And yet, you know, what we saw at Aperture, there were no seats, and people just stayed for hours looking and talking and asking and then putting up these little post-it notes. And so the energy of that was incredibly exciting. Different than, you know, the normal opening of a show in which everyone's seeing their friends and drinking wine and the work they'll come back to, right? The work just ignited these conversations. So that was very exciting. And so, Eric, I think we don't know the final form, but we're in a process letting it evolve, encouraging any of you to contribute. If you do have ideas of six more squares, please let us know what they might be.
while they're gathering their courage, I'm going to just point something out.
Sure.
Because you questioned the length of time. You said it might be more than 6 years. Ariella is the one who said it was six.
That's because that's Ariella's timeline.
Yeah.
But Wendy and I began the conversation before Ariella. Yeah. It's hard to say B.A.
Yeah.
Before Ariella is a pretty difficult thing. It's more like because of Ariella than B.A.
It reminded me of an earlier comment, because you, of course, were talking about the Kurdistan project, which you said was a 6.5 year project. And I remember at one point you telling me that when you were working on that project, as you were putting it together and as you were trying to close it, you just kept worrying that there were other photographs out there that you were missing, that weren't included. And so so one question is, how is it that you came to close that project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's also, you know, it had the website, it was ongoing, but you closed it, you turned it into something. And so does this project feel different to you?
Yeah.
Does it feel less able to be closed?
Well, maybe that's why there's a little bit, we've talked last night about the tension of the fixed form.
Yeah.
And my response to making the Kurdistan book was then 10 years later to making a new edition.
Yeah, that's true.
And then making AK Kurdistan as an invitation to ongoing contributions, mm-hmm. though I was so ahead of the internet, it wasn't possible really to do what I imagined at that time. And the storybooks, this is in a square very near Eduardo here, the Kurdistan project, called Kurdistan in the Shadow of History, and ongoing storybooks collected from the diaspora. So I'm much more aware of how little we have to build so much upon. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I know that it plays a role to some degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the case of Kurdistan, it had a huge value, different than any of us, most likely, seeing it as an object, but for that community, mm-hmm. feeling that they had a place, because they don't have a physical territory anywhere that's their own. They don't have a national archive. So in a book, and when Wendy said, take the book goes around, this book is banned in Turkey, so it has another problematic nature that it still can't be received by the community that participated in making it to some degree. So I think these beginnings and endings, or fixed or mutable forms, mm-hmm. you know, these are little details that we were very committed to, the magnets. It's not pinned up, but we wanted to give you the feeling that this is, you know, can change, can be moved, mm-hmm. can be expanded, even though if we put up any more squares, you know, it would overwhelm this gallery. And we were in the active process of including more squares in the summer. So this is, I think we have something like 12 more. So that's about 10, 12. I think we had about 100 projects, and we're now another 12%. We added about 12 projects between when Ryerson came down in March and we brought the work here. Mm-hmm. So you can feel that it's hard to close, mm-hmm. and closure in general is difficult.
Yeah. But we can make it another one in 5 years.
Oh yeah, we'll take Eric's model of multiple books.
No.
There is an online version, but if anyone's a genius, no.
Oh,
I mean, we'd love to. It's not that we're against it, it's that what it takes to do it, the resources, the management, etc.
I have a question. That's very, it's been very interesting. And that idea about the collaboration between the photographer and the photograph person is, you don't really feel that, but it resonates, and especially if you look at the photos. But in today's time, what struck me is selfies.
Yes.
Now the selfie, the photographer and the photograph person is the same. Mm-hmm. And so is there a collaboration? The only sense I have, there is a collaboration between the person and then the audience, because mm-hmm. The person is the photograph person, and the photographer, the only collaboration could be with the audience.
Correct.
That. If that makes sense.
And actually, right behind you with the apparatus grid, we have Cindy Sherman, who in a way is one of the original selfieites, or selfizing. I don't know if there's a verb.
Maybe we need a selfie square.
Yeah. Well,
But yeah, collaboration extends past the photographer and the photographed one.
Yeah.
To think of all the other ways. So we were talking earlier today about a large group collaboration with certain interpretations of certain pictures. And that's how we all collaborate to agree that a picture... Here's another example, the My Lai Massacre. I've forgotten the photographer.
Nick Gut?
Yeah, Nick Gut. No, it's not Nick Gut. It's not the girl.
The burning girl.
No, it's the...
The My Lai Massacre.
It's the... Yeah, and the there's... Yeah. And there's... there's a photograph of she's a young woman and she's near her mother. She's buttoning her blouse. Nobody read that for years. But why is she rebuttoning her blouse? What was done to her before she was killed? And so we collaborate to see some things and not others. We collaborate in the making of photographic meaning. And so we don't want to, it's easy, it's attractive to grasp photographer and photographed person. But it's also a further challenge to think about collaboration as broadly and in as complex a way as possible, including us.
As viewers.
As viewers, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just a quick anecdote. I mean, when we did the Itinerant Languages Photography Project at Princeton, and elsewhere, Juan Funcuberta came and gave a lecture, he gave a keynote, and he opened it up with a video of someone taking a selfie. And it was a video of someone walking along the beach. All of a sudden, she sees a corpse in the ocean, in the sea, near the edge of the beach. And she freaks out a little bit, but then all of a sudden she collects herself and starts taking selfies with the corpse and moves the corpse around so that she can pose with the corpse. So it's a selfie that is, I mean, it's a selfie with somebody else, but an unwilled collaboration with this body, right? Which is kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah.
Right.
Hi, I've been reading the manifesto that you have next door, and I've just noticed that you have used the symbol at, right, as in email, as in those, I don't know, I suppose it's at, right? I mean, so you're using that symbol to organize your thoughts, I mean... I'm just curious, is it random? And it strikes me as quite sharp, but why do you use that symbol?
Sharp and what?
Sharp. Yeah. I mean, it just struck me.
Like,
Because you could use other symbols, right? Or you can just like put different paragraphs there and. You know, I'm just curious why.
We liked it. It seemed to point, but at.
Oh, right.
It's.
What do you think?
I don't know. That's why. Is there something collaborative there? I mean, I don't know, but it's stretching the point. But it's like.
Well, it does reference email, absolutely, and email connected over. Like, it was something before it was email. Who knows what it was? I don't remember what it was before it was email, but it existed as a type.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. There's something precise about this symbol, right? I mean, it's like pointing. Place or maybe connecting things like the hosting, email, and your name.
Before you thought of it as email, that symbol, if you went, you know, that made that symbol, it usually meant each.
Right.
You know, it was each. Something like, you know, you would say 12, you know, balls at such and such. Each cost, each, for example. So we're playing off of that symbol to suggest a series of each point, each point, each point, each point. It's not like just one synthesis. It's each of these things, right. Each of these things. So I would say that's the closest we could explain to
right.
okay. how that symbol evolved and what its history is that you don't even probably think about now right, because right. it means something totally different to you or your generation. Yeah. You know, it's...
Okay. Thank you.
Somebody back there.
So I was going to say that I'm really struck by the neatness of the squares. It's just, when I looked at it, it just seemed so neat. Everything was so well organized. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question coming from this is, why squares? Why not something that would, I don't know, introduce sort of porosity maybe, like other shapes, maybe a transparent paper or something like that?
Do you want to respond to that? I mean, Federica is no longer with us. She was here last night and yesterday, earlier this morning. She comes out of architecture and talked a lot about the square and the grid, basically as a primary unit of architecture, right? We weren't thinking about that association, but we were trying to figure out a way, and you can see it in that first slide we showed with the blue tape, to organize the material, separate what happens within a set of one frame of a square in counterpoint to others. So we were just, you know, can you do that as well with a circle? Not so sure you can, right? We have spaces. Yes, they're rectangles versus squares. When you have rooms, psychologically, this is a very long room. It would be better if it was a wider audience and we were closer, but it's what we have, right? I think we had a modular sense that it was going to be efficient to organize the complex material within, as Wendy said, to kind of make it coherent and accessible within. These juxtapositions are your own associations. When you say neat, I mean, we talked about this earlier, that we move from an analog pin it all up within the blue tape to a digital format, which was in order to be able to print these out and provide it to Slout, et cetera, in an organized fashion that would make it, they're modular, they're singular, so they could be moved around, right? The order could be changed. They're not chronological. There's no we propose a grid formation, but it could be altered. And as you see, for the most part, and I mean, it's interesting to see here because we couldn't do this digitally, is that some, you know, there is this basic unit someone was talking about within the grid, in the square is a 3x3 positioning. And you can see every once in a while we're breaking that, not just formatting it 3 in a row or a 5, but also enlarging a particular image, right? And you see we make a panoramic here. We disrupt the template of what also we think helps organize the material. But none of us are designers. So all of this is just intuitive prioritizing, trying to bring your eye. We're trying to standardize, so you'll see that there's italic for a certain voice of a subject or of an author versus a font that's a Roman, which is the describing voice, which is different than the participatory voice. So there's subtle things in that, in the text, as Laura was mentioning. But for the most part, we're trying to use that template to make it as coherent and accessible and not too dense. The density is the biggest challenge, I'm sure, for all of you spending time with it, the density of associations. Anything else?
I'll say that the neatness has something to do with the talent of the crew that installed it.
We can give them credit too.
It's not to be taken for granted.
Yeah. But also, you know, there is a kind of building block quality to it, right? Because you have there are squares, there are blocks, and it's a way in which you continue to build the grid as if it was out of building blocks, right? In some way.
Yeah. And these grids have started as 3x3 and been extended. 3 is the highest, but then over 4, over 5, over 6. Has been the way it grows.
Right, right. I'll stay back here.
Yeah, should we? Yeah, great. Well, thank you all for being so interested.
And here?
Oh,
from somebody who helped install.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, how challenging it was.
I just said, as more categories are made, do projects ever shift, like switch category, as you see overlaps?
They have. In fact, Wendy and I both noticed simultaneously as Laura was speaking in the back right that we're still not happy with Sophie Call's project. You should look at that project. It's in the back on the right. It's a brilliant project. Sophie Call is unquestionably brilliant, and her, you know, which of her many projects, we chose the one that's about her working as a maid, sort of spying on the people in each room. So she's collaborating in a way with the absent
hotel
guest, and documenting what they leave behind as a representation of them. And so when we put that in potentializing violence, she might not like that category. But we thought, it's right on that edge, and yet we're not sure. So both of us independently, just as you were speaking, saying, just not so sure if Sophie Call's in the right place. Yeah. And in the morning, one of the students was starting to talk about the possibility of absence and the imaginary space, Carlos, and we were thinking, maybe we're getting ready for a new cluster, and there would be enough new ideas to bring together, and maybe she would sit more beautifully there as a centerpiece to the absence, the imagined relationship that isn't evident in the same way that some of these are. So that's about closure that is very difficult because, of course, we're inspired to do more.
See, but that's a good thing about a book, you know. You can only
It closes at a certain point.
It opens and closes.
And you can only have a certain number of pages.
Yeah.
You know.
That forces a defined state.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
Last night, Laura, you had, this question is for all three of you, but last night, Laura, you had like really beautifully and poetically spoken about how at one point you had thrown out there that the exhibition has, this project has infected the way you think.
Yeah.
I think what you meant was that how you think more generally, right? How not just within the confines of this conversation around photography and collaboration. So could maybe the three of you, however briefly or expansively you want to take it, like could you talk about how this project has infected, to use that very poignant term, how you think about the world?
I don't know, maybe being there from the beginning is maybe a little harder to answer that. Because I think we started with one idea, which was sort of more about best practices as photographers. And but then with the accumulation of Laura and Ariella, I think that helped us think about photography not just as practitioners, but also including the audience, and including things that might or might not happen. I think that that's how I've changed. I mean, I think I felt very rooted in the process, and now, you know, think more expansively about that process.
Gee, I think. It's a great question, Aaron. I think there are lots of ways to approach how to respond to that. On one level, one thing is to have a conversation with one person in an ongoing way, inside an ongoing relationship. So we've known each other for 46 years. That's a long time. And you're not always in conversation, but they're reference points in time. So this was very natural for us. Yeah. I think it changes when you start to talk with people who have a different vocabulary and a different perspective. And some of what we might have begun to think about was challenged in, I think, productive ways, which we all were open to thinking more deeply about what the spectrum of collaboration means. And I don't mean just in the sense of them. It's easy to point to Garanger obliged to take a photograph of a woman without a veil and kind of question the moral, ethical position there. I mean that collaboration is also very, very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, we are in some ways the most inefficient group. The representation of time is not by our choice, but it's by the reality of our complex lives to intersect meaningfully as we need to. That's also a fact of the collaboration. And I would just add that in the world, you know, what has been, and it comes through in this project, every time someone brings a square, and it could be any of you or it could be us, to our attention, it makes you think about why hadn't you considered that? Mm-hmm. Why didn't you, you know, what we don't know becomes incredibly exciting. So in that way, it goes back to your idea of the building blocks that we are rebuilding, and you said this last night, we are of a time that we have the privilege of this deep reflection of time and see how things have changed. So I might point out that Wendy did the work in Portraits and Dreams she told you about in Kentucky, and I happened to do the work with Omar with the Syrian refugees. You know, when I saw that work, I immediately knew about Wendy. I was stunned he didn't, and that's incredibly exciting, that it's kind of like the bees that, you know, or the birds that fly and fertilize, and you never see where the seeds will grow. There's something very exciting just to see how this then inspires other kinds of work, thinking, writing.
Conversations.
So that's kind of my sense.
I don't think I have much of better substance to say, but what you have here are two masterful practitioners with decades of this kind of work, thinking about how to do this kind of work from the very beginning, which is so interesting. We are of the same generation, and Susan and I went to college together. And it's true, if you live long enough, you get to think about it. It's quite a remarkable period of time. But you have, this is not new. This project is 6 or 8 or 10 or whatever years old, but the practice here that you have started from the very beginning of their work. I'm an academic. I have a PhD in English and comparative literature. And, you know, we are not trained to think that you're supposed to collaborate. You're supposed to find your own, original thing and go into a library and use your own brilliant mind and your own resources to make your own reading of this thing, which then you claim forever as your own. So the thing is that it strikes you at first as lesser, kind of dangerous to your own status. Mm-hmm. Certainly junior colleagues and graduate students say, can I really do this kind of work? What kind of credit in academia can you possibly get? I mean, you can't collaborate across institutions. You can't collaborate across, departments. You can't collaborate across fields. There are all kinds of things that are set up on purpose to be barriers. And so this is not something that we, in my bailiwick, are encouraged to think is substantive. And so when then you discover that not only is it substantive, but it affects, inflects, and infects everything you think, if you sit with and entertain this idea, and it changes the way you see the world, then you think, huh, well, something is, this, there's a buried history here. I think it's purposely buried, actually. Mm-hmm. And what's exciting is to excavate what you're seeing is how will two photographers imagine out of their practice a history of this, and how will writers and theorists also deal with that? And it seems urgent. I mean, think about why would we want to do this? Think about why you would want to do this. And maybe you don't, but I mean, why do we need to do this? I think we need to do this. And the question is, why would one want to do this? What would be the rewards? Turns out the rewards are in different places than what you're used to, and they're profound. So that's my answer.
And that was additive.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And it was just as bad in photography.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about that.
Yeah.
God.
So
we are inviting you all to collaborate with us. In whatever form you choose, there's a lot of ways that Slot will continue to have the show and invite you to participate and really leave leave us your thoughts in what various forms and take the manifesto and stay as long as you like looking.